after saying that, saying, you are coming back to work, aren't you? Please come back to work for us. And they did not say, please come back to work for us after you drop your EEOC complaint. They just said, please come back to work for us. And they just didn't want to talk about the reason why. Now, who knows what would have happened after he'd gotten back to work. Maybe they would have made his life miserable after he got back to work. Maybe they would have drummed up some reasons to fire him after he got to work. Maybe they would have harassed him. Maybe his safety would have been at risk. You know, there are all kinds of things that would have happened if he would have shown up back to work after this chain of events. But, yeah, those things probably would have happened, but probably would have happened is not grounds for suing anybody. They didn't harass him. They didn't drum up reasons to fire him. They didn't make his life miserable. They didn't make his job unsafe. If they had done those things, it would be a different story, but they didn't do it because he wasn't there. So here, he lost because there was no adverse action. Now, one thing that they did point out, another potential grounds here, is that if that same threat had been made, and then the guy either did withdraw his EEOC complaint, or maybe didn't pursue it as zealously as he would otherwise, then perhaps the withdrawal of the EEOC case, perhaps that could have been a negative consequence that would give rise to a right to sue. But here, even though it probably looked likely that something would happen in this case, nothing really happened. The guy didn't get fired, so therefore he didn't have a case. So if you're gonna sue for employment discrimination, make sure that you get fired unequivocally. Another employment case also arising in Indiana, the Indianapolis Police Department, a 1978 consent decree. There was a lot of allegations back then of discrimination in hiring in the Indianapolis police and fire departments. A lawsuit was brought, and it was inevitably unsettled with a consent decree. It said a number of things. It stated kind of a laudatory goal that what this consent decree aims to do is to fill all positions within the department without regard to color and make sure that persons of various races are represented throughout the department. It said that in initial hiring, a certain number of slots in the incoming academy classes would be reserved for African American recruits. And it said, quote, promotions shall be based upon relevant standards and criteria, which will be applied without regard to race or color. Well, this case was lieutenants who wanted to move up to captain, I think. So they took the test, they got the highest scores, they wanted to be promoted. But these white officers were passed over because of some African-American officers were given preference. And the city came back and said, the white officers sued, citing discrimination, saying we were discriminated against because of our race. Well, the city made the argument that, we are subject to qualified immunity because of the consent decree from 1978. And the law, setting this Martinez case, which is an Eighth Circuit case, says that if you, in good faith, follow the terms of a consent decree in earlier litigation, that gives you qualified immunity for later litigation arising out of those actions. So they said, that's unfortunate, but we're entitled to qualified immunity based upon the consent decree. Well, the court said no, in a pretty easy case. The case is notable because they adopted in the Seventh Circuit this Martinez test, saying that qualified immunity does apply. But under the facts of this case, no, there was no qualified immunity. Because the city argued that, the consent decree did say that our goal is to fill all positions throughout the department equally. We want representative we want the diversity of our force to be representative of the diversity of the community throughout the force, not just the cops on the beat, but throughout our hierarchy. And that's what this kind of the general overriding goal of this consent decree was. But here, the Court of Appeals said, but yes, that's your overall general goal, but in construing any kind of contract or statute, the specific always takes precedence over the general. So yes, that might be your general goal, but when you specify the specifics of how you're going to accomplish that, you said all promotions shall be based on the standards and criteria without regard to race or color. And that's exactly what you did here. You promoted some persons because of their race or color. Maybe it was in good faith because you were following that general goal of the consent decree. But to get qualified immunity, you have to indeed be following the letter of what the consent decree said, not just some kind of abstract meaning based upon some general goal. Well, moving into the environmental field, this next case, McAvoy v. IEA Barge, also a case arising in Illinois. It's a suit under the Clean Air Act, the Federal Clean Air Act. The Clean Air Act, obviously, it's a federal statute, but it calls for kind of a complicated relationship between state and federal law. And here, well, you can bring a citizen suit against a polluter for somebody else's violation of a state regulation that imposes a emission standard or limitation. So if there's a Illinois statute or a Minnesota statute that says you can have X milligrams per liter, or however you measure it, and they give a specific number of particulates coming up in the air, or sulfur dioxide, or who knows what. If there's a quantified limitation in state law, then you can bring a federal lawsuit based upon that. Well, here they brought it under. Here, what it was a coal barge. You have this dock where coal is loaded onto barges. And as you might guess, that's kind of a dusty proposition. And if you live next door to where they're loading the coal barge, there might be coal dust floating around. And sure enough, there was. Well, the neighboring property owners brought a lawsuit saying, well, wait, we can bring this under the Clean Air Act because they're violating two Illinois regulations. One regulation says that you can't pollute in Illinois. And the other statute was a little bit more specific, saying you can't have fugitive particulate matter, dust, if there's dust emanating from your property. And it talked about the definition. If you're standing on your property looking toward the zenith, if there's an excessive amount of particulate matter, it's against the law for your neighboring property owner to do that. Well, that's fine and good that you can use these state laws, but they have to be a standard or a limitation. They can't just be a general, like one of these saying, you can't pollute in Illinois. Because that's what the rest of the Clean Air Act says anyway. So, I mean, that's not adding anything new. They said this fugitive particulate law was a little bit closer call because that had some standards. It said you had to be looking at the zenith, but it didn't say how much. You know, it didn't say it'll block X percent of the light or, you know, have a certain opacity measurement or anything like that. So this was not the kind of standard that the Clean Air Act sought to apply. In respect, talks about removal of a judge. Just one final one I'll talk about, and I just want to mention, because I think whatever jurisdiction you're in, I think this one might be relevant. Kind of three pretty good law review articles written on kind of an obscure subject, but one that comes up every now and then. Bodum USA versus La Cafetière. This is one of those cases with pictures. So it had a picture of a little French press coffee maker. It's a good way to make one or two cups of coffee. And it was some kind of commercial dispute about that. That was governed by French law. And the question of how do you prove up French law? How do you prove foreign law in a U.S. court? Federal Rule of Evidence 44.1 says that one of the methods you can use is affidavits from experts, namely attorneys or law professors from France, saying that, you know, if this case had come up in France, the plaintiff would have won because this is what our law says. And the other side comes in with affidavits saying, if this case had come up in France, the defendant would win because that's what our law says. And two of the judges, or maybe the third one a little bit, kind of criticized that practice, saying, yes, that's one of the methods that you can use to apply foreign law. But, you know, we're judges, we know a thing or two about the law. A lot of material is printed in English. Even if it's not printed in English, it can be translated. The two of the judges, and Judge Posner in particular, did not like the practice of using these foreign affidavits to prove foreign law. He said, no, the statute, especially if it's a common law country or an English-speaking country, you know, clearly if we have an English statute, we can read the English statute. But even if it's a French statute here, we can read a translation of that. There are books about it. We don't like that practice so much of affidavits. The final judge, they all concurred, but his opinion was, I wouldn't go quite so fast to throw out these affidavits because, you know, there are a lot of nuances and we might need some of those. You can't just pick up a French law book and know exactly what's going on. So suggested a little bit more caution. But like I say, there are three pretty good law review articles taking slightly different positions on that. So if you ever do have a case involving proving up foreign law in a U.S. courtroom, there'll be something to fit almost every taste from what's in there. And well, I see that we're gone over by a couple of minutes. So unless you have any questions, yes?
You have to have three of those coverts for Wisconsin.
Thank you very much. Yes. Yes, thank you. I would have had to go back and dub the tape. Yes, thank you. For our podcast listeners, our third code word for today, we're on the subject of lakes, and today we are in a room here looking out the window over Lake Como. So our third code word for the podcast viewers is Como, C-O-M-O. It's smaller than the other two lakes that are mentioned. So it's Como, as in Lake Como in Minnesota, or